Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And we're also happy to have back on the program once again Scott Spiess from the Spiess Home Inspection Service. This is our monthly show on home maintenance. We do it every month on a Monday. And that's the way we start the week off, to give you the chance to ask questions. You know, maybe you got some kind of problem. You're not quite sure how to solve it. You have some issues with energy efficiency, or you got a leaky basement, or you're concerned about your gutters, or you're wondering about your roof, or anything like that. That's what we do on these programs. So if you have a question, give us a call, and I know that Scott will try and help you out. Give us the best description you can of the problem, and we'll see what we can do for you. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you want to do that. That's will-talk@illinois.edu at any point here. You can give us a call. Hey, thanks very much for being here.
Well, good morning, David. Once again, always a pleasure.
We have somebody ready to go. Might as well get right to him. And this is somebody on our line one here in Champaign County, where we are. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Got two questions. One is there, are there any problems using primed and painted 3/4-inch plywood for exterior siding?
They do make plywood that is rated for exterior use. It has a different glue, a more water-resistant glue. A standard plywood for external siding is not going to work as well because it is not rated as an exterior plywood, so you would have to check the rating on it to see what they've done as far as how they've got it glued together. Because even though it's primed and painted and sealed, you will get moisture through humidity moving through the plywood. So if you have an indoor rated plywood and you put it on the outside, it can give you problems. But
and
if you've
what
used
kind
it,
of problems we get?
Well, the glue will get soft and start delaminating the plies, and it'll start coming apart on you.
Okay.
Priming and painting it will slow it down quite a bit because it'll pretty much seal everything. But you've still got a glue in there that is more of a water base than anything else. So you get an exterior grade plywood, you should be all right. Most roof sheathings, things like that, are exterior grade. They actually make a foundation grade plywood where you can put it direct burial into the ground, but that would be overkill for siding. So yeah, make sure you get an exterior type plywood, and yes, you can use it for a siding.
Okay, that's good. My next question is, I've got a grain storage bin that's corrugated steel, and I removed some seal around the base of it, and I'm not going to replace the seal, a seal on the inside of the bin. And so I've got some rust that has occurred between the seal and the siding. So my question is, will muriatic acid remove that rust from the steel?
Muriatic acid is more for removing mortar from brick. They do make more of a naval jelly. They do make some rust prohibitive chemicals. They also make some paints that you can spray on it that are designed to change the chemical makeup of the rust and turn it into basically a primer that you can then paint back over.
Oh, really?
So there's a couple of different things, but muriatic acid is not the one that I would use for rust, no.
Okay. So what do you know what kind of paint I would ask for that would remove it?
Well, I know in the automotive industry it's called a POR-15. Yeah, if you do a search for that, I'm sure it will come up.
Okay, good. Okay, thanks a lot, Scott.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. Thank you. On to the next caller. This is somebody in Charleston and line two. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
I have a question regarding insulating an older home. I recently had an energy audit done, and they recommended insulating the walls. But I've seen some conflicting information online and from other sources saying if you have an older home, it isn't airtight, and it's not supposed to be airtight, and there are concerns about moisture building up in the wall cavities. And normally, if there's no insulation in there, that's fine. It just goes to the outside. But if you put insulation in there, the moisture builds up, and you can end up with some rotting or molding issues. And when I asked the energy auditor about that, they hadn't heard of that issue before. And then when they checked with their home office, They said that typically they will put in borax into the fiberglass blown-in insulation or the cellulose, and that will take care of any molding issues. So my question, though, is I've been seeing conflicting information, some fairly reputable sources online, and I was just wondering your opinion.
Oh, well, my opinion is if you've got moisture in the walls, that means you've got too much humidity in the house. And if we fix the humidity problem in the house, then we don't have the moisture in the walls.
Okay.
In order to get moisture condensing in the walls, what happens is we have to have a cold surface and we have to have a high humidity.
Okay.
Generally speaking, we have found that if, particularly if you've got a crawl space house, if you were to put a plastic vapor barrier down over the soil surface to act as a preventative to keep the humidity from coming into the house, that controls the moisture enough that you're not going to get condensation on the outside walls. Therefore, the insulation is not a problem. Where they're talking about is if you have insulation in the walls and you have high humidity in the house, the insulation is not airtight, so you can get the vapor pressure to push the moisture through the insulation, and then it then condenses on whatever substrate is on the outside, such as a plywood or the siding, depending on how the house is built. And you can get actually a mold and mildew it's on the outside of the insulation, on the inside of whatever your sheathing is.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got that condensation, if you've got that moisture, then you've got a humidity problem in the house.
Okay.
If we fix the humidity problem in the house by eliminating the moisture source or keeping it well ventilated through the attic or fans or things like that, then it's not that big an issue. I would say the advantages of insulating the walls far outweigh the disadvantages.
Okay. Is there a magic percentage of humidity in the house? Because we like to keep it fairly moist because it feels warmer. So I think sometimes we'll keep it around 40%, which I think is a little on the high side.
In the wintertime, that is extremely high.
Okay.
My guess is if you were to open your attic hatch and look up in the attic, you'd find frost on all the bottom of all the roof sheathing and balls of frost on the nail heads.
Okay.
That is extremely high, particularly when it gets cold. See, there's no one number to use out there. We're talking about relative humidity. Relative to what? We're talking about relative to outdoor temperatures. So when the outdoor temperature changes, the humidity level in the house has to change.
Mm-hmm.
And since we don't have 3 days in a row in central Illinois that have the same temperature, we've got to be adjusting this humidity level in the house constantly.
Okay.
And you're much better off to err on the dry side than you are on the wet side just because of the mold, mildew, and moisture, et cetera.
Okay. So maybe somewhere between 15 and 20 or even lower than that?
Well, it's going to depend on the day. If it's zero outside, 15 or 20 could be considered high. If it's 35 outside, then you maybe need 35 to 40 to be considered high.
Okay, so if you have a furnace humidifier where you set it for a particular setting, you might need to adjust that on a regular basis depending on the humidity outside.
Exactly. And actually, most of the humidifiers, if you look at the controls, it gives you a rough scale on it that says if outdoor temperature is, set the humidifier at approximately. And it basically at about 30, it stops. And at, like, I think at 0 degrees, are usually in the 10 to 15% range or 10 to 15 on the numbers. Now, the other thing you have to realize is that humidistat that you have on the wall, it's exposed to the air in order to measure the humidity, which means once it's about 3 or 4 years old, it's got enough dust and dirt on it that it's no longer accurate. So your best barometer for figuring out how much humidity you can have in the house is your windows. If you've got a little bit of moisture on the window, you've got too much humidity in the house.
Okay.
If you wake up in the morning and there's that thin film of water, particularly down low, yep, you've got it set too high. Now, if you walk across the carpet and you reach for the light switch and the switch reaches back, then it's probably a little bit too dry.
Understood.
So there is a happy medium there, but and your humidistat will give you a rough idea, but it's not going to be 100% accurate because the older it gets, the less efficient or less accurate it is because of the amount of dust and dirt on it.
Okay. So if I can take care of the humidity issues, then it might be safe to go ahead and insulate the walls.
Yes, that would be my opinion.
All right. Thank you. you very much.
All right, very good. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always on a Monday to talk about home maintenance. And we have some other folks here ready to go. Questions are welcome. We'll take as many as we can, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. On the toll-free line, we have someone in Mattoon, and this is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
I have a question regarding two parts. One, I have a ranch-style home that faces the roof, where the roof faces the west. For about a period of a month, late last winter, four of these shingles came off, and they were spaced about in a line, a vertical, about 4 or 5 feet apart, three of them up the house, and they came off for different periods, and another one about 2 foot from that came off. Nothing since, and there seems to be plenty of grit on the shingles, and they're not turned up. Any particular reason they would have done that?
Well, there's a couple of different things could have happened. First of all, I think shingles sell wholesale at about 5 cents a pound, so the quality control on the shingles is not great. So it's possible that you may have had a bundle of shingles that had a poor tar strip on them. Basically, when you lay a shingle down, there is a strip of tar about halfway down the middle of the shingles. That's when you put the next one on top of it, it's supposed to glue the tab down. And for a while there, they were actually experimenting with, when we went to new fiberglass shingles, we're talking back in the 70s and 80s, the glue would glue them down too tight, and so they started putting things like a plastic strip and gluing that to the back of one shingle so it would would adhere to the tar on the bottom of the shingle next to it, under it, and to get the right amount of slip so that we didn't get tearing as the roof expanded and contracted with temperature and moisture changes. So it's not uncommon to find some where either the glue strip wasn't put on correctly or some dust and dirt got blown underneath it before it had a chance to seal. Most of the time when I find shingles that have blown up, it's houses that have been roofed in the wintertime, so the tar didn't get good and hot, so it didn't seal the tabs down. We got a little bit of wind blowing some dust and dirt around, and so it's sort of like taking a piece of Scotch tape and sticking it to your shirt before you try and hold anything together with it. It just doesn't seal as well. And that's probably what you've got, is a couple of defective shingles. It's a matter of going up there, finding the loose ones, put a little dab of roofing cement, blackjack underneath them, and glue them back down, and you'd be in good shape.
Now, these that half is broken off, so you got half the there are the four spots that have half the shingle, you know, like about 4 inches high and half the shingle width long.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the proper repair that needs to be done to correct that problem, other than can you fix the area and not the whole roof?
Yes, yes, you can. Usually, I've been doing a little bit of it here lately. You get the pry bar and you break the glue bond on the shingles above it, and you pull them up and pull those nails out, pull the bad shingles out, slide a new one in, nail it down, and then put a little bit of roofing tar back on the ones above it and glue it back down. So, yes, you can replace two or three shingles in that area.
And will you have damaged much of the other area doing that process?
Usually not, unless a shingle is already nearing its expected life. In other words, if you try and do this on a roof that's 18 years old, then yeah, you probably can damage some of the shingles because they're already getting brittle and old enough to where they're not going to last much longer. But most of the time we find this happens on a house that's 2, 3, 5 years old, something like that, in which case the shingles are still flexible enough and the tar is still pliable enough that they can be popped up and sealed back down.
Okay, good. Thank you. And the other part of my question was, in the garage, the floor has got a film and some stains throughout the floor. Can that be cleaned up in any degree to get some of those spots off there? And then there's also a small hairline crack, maybe like two of them in the middle of the door that comes in from the door edge about 6-8 inches. Not really hurting anything I can see, but can they be covered in anything? The same with the outside edge where they sawed up to the door. The saw mark is about 4 inches from the door, then a crack now is developed from there to the foundation of the garage. Can any of that be fixed?
Well, anytime you pour concrete, you're going to get cracks. Generally, when they saw the cuts in, that's just to make the cracks go in a straight line so they look like they're intended to be there. It's still just an expansion crack. When you pour concrete, it comes in wet off the truck. It dries. When it dries, it shrinks. So I'm going to call it, most of those cracks are going to be shrinkage cracks. There is also a little bit of movement quite often around the automotive door because of the lack of footing underneath the main portion of the automotive door, so we can get a little bit of movement. We can also get some frost heave of the driveway apron. So there's a couple different areas that can cause the cracking. Most of the time, it is not an issue. The floor in the garage is a floating slab. It's not part of the foundation. It's not part of what holds up the garage walls. So as long as the cracks are not sticking up an inch where they're a trip hazard or something like that, they make some pour-on type crack sealers. Basically, it's a free-flowing putty or liquid that you can keep nice and warm in the house and then pour it into the crack, and it'll self-level and seal up and make the cracks look a lot better cosmetically. Like I say, they're not really hurting anything, so as long as we're doing a cosmetic repair, that's about all that we need to do. So I probably wouldn't worry too much about the cracks.
Okay, and as far as trying to clean the stain and that off the floor?
There are some very specific concrete cleaners. They're a little bit, I don't want to say acidic, but definitely a little bit more caustic than what you'd use for your household cleaners. And they work quite well. Just about any automotive store will have, or even the big box stores, the Home Depot type places, will have some concrete cleaner.
Okay. Sounds good. We'll give it a try.
Yeah, right, it's got a real good soap to it, and it lifts most of the stains out.
All right. Well, thank you.
Very good. Thank you. We'll go on to Urbana. This is the next caller, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm going to get a garage sited, and I guess I just want you to talk me through how I go about getting bids. I'd kind of like to get three bids. You know, what kinds of questions I should ask and some recommendations of people I should call for bids.
Okay, I'm going to assume that we're starting with a wood-sided garage that has got some peeling paint and not looking real good at the moment, and we want to make it look a lot prettier.
You got it.
Okay. Kind of thought that's where we were going. Since the garage is not, quote-unquote, living space, I'm assuming it's also a detached garage, not an attached garage.
Yes.
Okay. Since it's not a living space, we don't have to worry about doing insulation behind the siding and stuff. Although, when you're putting a vinyl siding on, it's probably not a bad idea to put a thin foam, what they call a fan fold foam, over the top. What it does is not, they bill it out as being insulation. Well, it's thin enough, it's not really insulation. But what it does is it gives a nice smooth surface for the vinyl siding to lay on so that you don't telegraph the wood siding underneath it. It'll make it look a little bit better. So it's not a bad idea to put a fan fold foam over the top of it.
Okay.
Since we already have the wood siding and that is supposed to be our weather barrier, the building is already pretty weather tight. I really like to see the fan fold foam taped at the seams with a proper tape, not duct tape, but a proper sealing tape, so that we don't get moisture in behind the foam and have it sealed around windows and such.
Okay.
Once that is done, we have a nice tight wrap around the garage. Then we can put the vinyl siding on and shouldn't have too many problems.
Okay. Can you recommend people that I can call?
Well, I'm going to stay away from actually recommending any specific names. What you would want to do is see if you could find some people in the area that have something that looks nice. Ask who had them done. Make some phone calls. Do your homework. There are some good companies. There are some companies that they hire a lot of small crews, and they tend to go through the crews on a regular basis, which tells me that they're not necessarily the best installers out there. You're just going to have to find yourself a reputable company. And either, if you've got a friend that does real estate work, they usually know somebody. If you've just got somebody in the area that's already done some maintenance or upgraded on their house and it looks nice, or they may be able to tell you who does good work, or may be able to tell you who not to use.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. Welcome on to Champagne, and this is another caller here, line number two. Hello.
Hi. I have an older house, and I have a cistern in the backyard, and I was wanting to reconnect it to my gutters. And to install a pump to be able to use it. So I have to clean it, seal it, reconnect the gutters, and put a pump in. Do you have any experience?
Okay, what are we going to be using it for?
I just want to use it instead of rain barrels. I want to use it in
for watering purposes.
Yeah.
Okay, because in no way are you allowed to connect it to any type of water system in the house.
Right, and there is a there's a very old house, and there's a big tank, open tank up in the attic, and I was told that there used to be a hand pump, and they would use it for brown water.
That is exactly correct. What the cistern did originally when the house was built, and I'm going to guess somewhere in the 1910, 1920 range.
Yeah, that's right.
They basically used this as softened water. They would take the water from the gutter systems. They would put it into a large tank, let the sediment fall out of it. Then they would pump it up to basically a horse trough up in the attic area. And then if you were to go into the bathroom, there would be three spigots or three faucets there. You would have your hot, your cold, and the center one would be your soft water. It was not for drinking or anything like that, but it was for a soft water for washing clothes, et cetera, instead of the hard water from the well. So, yeah, they did use them regularly up till about 1925 or 1930 when we started coming up with softeners and such to do it instead of using the rainwater, and we had more city water systems.
Yeah, so, yeah. When I first saw it up there, I had no idea, you know, because it had to be built into the house.
Yeah, because you're not going to get it back up in the attic.
No.
What I do recommend is that we go up there and look where the pipes go down, the pipes that went up to it. And make sure that they're sealed so we don't have any air from the attic going down around them. Because if you were to ever have a fire in the house, holes that go from the basement all the way to the attic do a good job of feeding air to the fire.
Oh, okay.
So you want to make sure that the chase that those pipes are run in are blocked at the top and bottom.
All right. I've never really noticed them, but they might be up there. Okay.
Yeah. There's going to be pipes that run up to that horse trough because they didn't carry it up by buckets.
Right.
So there is some piping, which means there's a chase from the basement all the way to the top. So that's something you want to check into. Other than that, if you fill the cistern and you find that you have moisture in the basement, you will probably realize that the cistern is no longer watertight, and it can create all sorts of moisture issues in the house. If you get the inside the cistern sealed so that it will hold water without leaking drastically, then yes, you can put a pump in it and use it for a garden hose, watering flowers and things like that.
Okay. And are people rehabilitating these things regularly?
Or? As a general rule, no. So finding somebody that has experience in it could be difficult.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, that's interesting. We have quite an old house, and there is a cistern which has been filled in. It was filled in with gravel, which I guess was the standard advice, and long before we had the house. And the idea of reusing that, I guess it would not even have occurred to me.
Not once it's been filled in. And I suppose I should clarify one more thing, that if our caller is going to use the cistern, mm-hmm. that he needs to have a good cover on it that can be latched and locked to prevent small children from getting curious, because there is no ladder in there. If so, a small child, even if they're only 4 to 6 feet deep, it's enough that if a small child were to fall into the cistern, that there could be drastic repercussions.
Yeah.
I know that my father, who I get a lot of this information from,
yes.
when he was growing up, it was not uncommon to hear of kids in the area that drowned in the cistern.
Really?
Because
yeah.
Let's face it, kids and water are like magnets. They go well together. So if you're going to use a cistern and fill it with water, make sure that it has a good, secure lid that can be latched or locked so mm-hmm. that you have some safety.
And would it be likely that the walls were some kind of ceramic, were brick, were tile, was metal? What's it made out of?
Depending on when it was made, most of the original ones were brick. They were hand-laid brick. Mm-hmm. And there are some out there that are concrete, but for the most part, they're brick, which means brick is porous, which, of course, lets water go through there. So it's not uncommon for somebody to fill their cistern and then suddenly find that one wall of their house has moisture seeping through it. Since usually the house that's old enough to have the cistern is also old enough to have a brick foundation wall, mm-hmm. and the brick foundation wall is not impervious to water penetration. So, yeah, they can create a lot of problems. Since we don't need the softened water anymore, most of them have been filled in. And for safety, the lids need to be locked, latched, welded somehow or another so that small children or curious adults don't fall into them.
All right. We're talking this morning about home maintenance. We do it every month. It's always a Monday. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. So if you have a question, call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's somebody in Charleston. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We bought a house about 4 years ago, and about 5 years before that, they had added or expanded on the upstairs bathroom, which required cutting out the roof and putting in a dormer. This was the cause of some water damage down in the office in the first floor with because they didn't flash very well, which we didn't figure out until 3 years later. And what I'm wondering is if it's possible to lay new flashing down on top of the existing shingles with a liberal coating of tar or something underneath, and then re-shingling or re-siding the dormer itself so that the water would flow down the new siding onto the new flashing onto the existing shingles, or do I really need to tear the siding off, which is actually shingles, off of the dormer and tear up the existing shingles on the roof and redo all of the old flashing?
I would highly recommend removing all the old stuff and go down and find the actual source. Among other things, once you take off the shingles, you'll be able to find the water trail, the dark sheathing and such, and find out exactly where the water's coming from. It
okay.
really is not going to take much on an expense-wise to tear off and trace it down and redo it.
Okay.
And the problem being, if you were to just put all new stuff, depending on how far up you went with the new shingles as to where the leak is actually coming in from, it's amazing where water can start coming into something to create a leak. I mean, it may your water actually getting underneath the sheathing or underneath your shingles or getting underneath your flashing could be 10, 15 feet away from where you think the problem is. That's why for an investigative purposes, I highly recommend that the first thing you do is start pulling stuff off and trace back where exactly is the problem. And that way we can get the flashing done and put it down right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take a little break here. We'll have some more calls, talk some more with Scott Spies after we take our usual mid-show break. And we'll have more Focus. Stay tuned.
Did you know that you can support WILL without sacrificing income that you may need during your lifetime? Leave your own legacy for the future of the station. Join the Legacy Circle visionaries who have provided a gift through their estate. It's simple and it's easy. For more information, call Don DeBeard at 217-333-7300 or go online at will.illinois.edu. You are an essential part of our future.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, Monday through Friday, from 10 until noon, and we have different topics for you every day. In the second hour today, Dr. Suzanne Troopin will be here. She's an obstetrician and gynecologist. Every other month she's on the program, we talk about women's health. Tomorrow morning at 10, we will review current events in Burma. And it certainly seems that the country has now embarked on a period of very rapid change, including the release, after 15 years of house arrest, of the democracy leader and opposition politician Aung San Suu Kyi. So tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk with Christina Fink, a professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. And then also tomorrow, we'll talk with Howard Rheingold, a guy who's been writing for a long time now, on issues like the internet and virtual communities. And we'll talk about his new book, NetSmart, How to Thrive Online, which is about making the most of social media. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon. You can check the schedule by going to the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. This is the morning that we take questions on home maintenance. Scott Spies is here. So if you got a problem, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. On again to another caller, and this is somebody in Champaign, and line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm curious, what I had a house at one point that I put wind turbine vents on, and it reduced the temperature in the attic in the summertime dramatically. I mean, it was so hot in the attic that you instantly broke out in sweat. Before I put those on, there was no, it was a national home. They didn't have any kind of air outlet in the upper part of the attic. They just provided vents in the under the eaves. So I'm curious, what would you say is the maximum temperature difference between the environment and inside the attic that you'd see in a properly ventilated attic space?
Well, ideally, if we have excellent ventilation, it's going to be ambient temperature. If it's 80 degrees outside, the attic's going to be 80 degrees. Now, that's not going to happen because we're going to get some solar gain. The shingles act like, I'm going to refer to them as a cooking stone. Basically, we got an asphalt shingle up there that we're baking in the sun, and it's going to take some time to get some air through there. So, yes, it's going to be warmer. The more ventilation, the less temperature change or difference you're going to get between that and ambient temperature. Once we start getting over about 130, 140 is when we start having problems with shingles. It gets them hot enough and soft enough, we can start losing the granule. We can start getting some curling on the shingles. It's not uncommon to find attics in the 120, 130 degree range. Usually, now you put the wind turbine units on there, usually that is not needed. Once the house gets that hot, the hot air wants to rise. If we have either a ridge vent or some type of vent down the center of the roof, we can get that air out because it's hot enough, it wants to go out. And as long as our soffit ventilation is not blocked, we should get a natural convection. That hot air wants to jump and run out the top of the roof, which means it's pulling a little bit of a low pressure, so it's going to pull air from the soffit ventilation. However, I find on a regular basis, particularly on, as you indicated, the national homes, the people have done some modifications. The original design actually vented pretty well. Unfortunately, the original design had, I think, 2.5 or 3.5 inches of insulation. Most people have increased that. A lot of the ventilation was the gable ends. People have resided them and blocked off all the gable ventilation and not made any changes to the actual attic ventilation. So your turbine vents probably did help quite a bit. But as far as whether or not we needed to put in turbine vents or whether we could have done the same thing with, you know, 5 or 6 button vents or a couple of big gable vents or even a ridge vent is questionable. My guess is you also had some blockage at your soffit ventilation because somebody added some extra insulation over the top of the roof and out towards the soffit areas that started getting up close to the sheathing and started reducing some of that airflow as well.
Well, I don't think that was the case in this home. I mean, I was the one that put the additional insulation in it. It didn't block the vents.
Okay.
The reason I added the turbine vents was because I noticed that the end of the nails were all rusty and there was a brown spot on the insulation directly below any of the nails. So it was obvious that there was moisture condensing on those nails and that there wasn't adequate ventilation. And having been in the attic and seen the gable ends, I know that there were never any vents in the gable ends. They just ventilated the eaves and thought that would be adequate, but I didn't think it was.
So yeah.
I was just curious if there was a standard or an expectation with a properly ventilated attic as to what that maximum temperature difference would be.
They don't go by temperature difference. They go by free flow airspace, and there is actually in the code an entire paragraph as to how many square feet of openable airspace that you have to allow for this, depending on how many square foot of the roof and the pitch of the roof. And the very last sentence of the paragraph is if deemed necessary. So they spend all this time writing out all these specifications and then put down at the bottom, if deemed necessary. My general take is there's no such thing as too much attic ventilation until it starts to leak. If you got leaks, you've probably got too much ventilation. But there is no such thing as too much ventilation because of exactly as you pointed out, the ambient air temperatures. Now, as far as the rust on the nail heads, Yes, that can be somewhat attributed to a lack of ventilation, but it also is more likely attributed to a high moisture content in the house or a high humidity problem, because the moisture didn't start in the attic. It started somewhere in the house, and having too much moisture in the house, it will condense on the first cold surface, and that's generally the roof sheathing, which is above the insulation. So rust on the nail heads usually has me looking for a moisture source rather than a ventilation source. But
it was a slab home without a humidifier, so it was just normal bathing and whatever else water source inside the house.
Unfortunately, there is no specification as far as ambient temperature versus attic temperature, but ventilation is good.
All right.
Thank you. Let's continue here. We got several callers, and Danville is next. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a brick ranch-style home, and people have commented that it smells musty. I had someone check the crawl space. He said it's completely dry under there. There's only one opening, and I wonder where that could be coming from. The house is not really open all that much. I live by myself. Any ideas about what?
Well, when he said the crawl space was dry, was there a plastic vapor barrier over the top of the soil surface down there?
I think so.
Because, yeah, I've found an awful lot of them, even though if they're quote-unquote dry and dusty underneath there, if you don't have that plastic vapor barrier, we can get a musty odor. The other thing it'd be to look for would be an old power humidifier on the furnace system that may or may not be used anymore that could have got some lime buildup or some mold and mildew issues on it. So if you've ever had a power humidifier or have one now, it may need cleaned.
Okay. So have them check whether or not that humidifier is really working?
Right. Yeah. They do need service every couple of years on those because of the amount of lime and salts and calcium deposits that can build up on them.
Would an additional opening into the at the foundation, would that help or be necessary or advisable?
I would say probably not. The crawl space, if we can keep it dry and we've got a good vapor barrier down there, really doesn't need that much ventilation. It should ventilate through the floors, and we have most of the time the heating and cooling systems go through the crawl space, so we're getting some air movement through the crawl space. The only time we really need to ventilate it is if we've got excess humidity or moisture down there. And so proper grading around the outside and a good vapor barrier should take care of most of that. So
okay.
I probably wouldn't worry about that. But okay. I'd make sure you've got a good vapor barrier and recheck that power humidifier if you've got one, just to make sure that it's operating properly. And those would be the first places I would start.
And if there isn't one on the furnace, one can be added?
I probably would not add one because as we're making the houses tighter and tighter with better windows and more insulation and stuff,
and
the need for them is much less than it used to be.
Yeah, we've had windows replaced, so I think the house is very tight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you probably don't need a power humidifier. So if you've got one, it may be running too much.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, very good. Let's continue. We'll go next to Champagne now, line number three. Hello.
Morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question relating to an issue that earlier caller brought up about the old cistern.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have an old cistern, or if it's too expensive to refurbish one, is a reasonable alternative some of those kind of large, I don't know what you call them, plastic containers, if you want a large amount of water for watering lawn and garden and that sort of thing, like they use in crop spraying and that kind of thing, that might hold 300 gallons or something like that. I don't know. I'm just making that number up. Can you do that? And anything? Do you have anything to say about how to do that or things to watch for if you try?
Okay.
It?
Well, most of that type of tank is not designed for a direct burial where you have a lot of pressure around it.
Uh-huh.
They do make some plastic tanks. They're more, more like a septic tank type unit. That could be used for a cistern.
Yeah, I was thinking of above ground.
Okay, if you've got it, yeah, above ground it's a little harder to get the water into it, and it tends to, the sunlight tends to like to grow bacteria and things like that. So, you can put just about anything that'll hold water above ground. Since we're just using it for lawn and garden type work, that's the whole purpose behind the rain barrels, and most of those are a polyethylene barrel. And they do make some fiberglass tanks that can hold water. For that matter, you could just use plain old horse trough and put a cover over the top of it. any number of different things. I know our caller was trying to use an existing one, and if somebody were wanting to put in a similar system, they do make some for burial, but you have to make sure it is designed for a burial system.
Right, and again, the above ground ones, if you want to go that way, and you can get the water in them by routing your downspouts and so forth. They make some of those that are larger than just a regular rain barrel that are opaque, so there's no bacteria thing. And,
mm-hmm. Yeah, you can get them just about as large as you want, up to almost swimming pool size.
Yeah, and do you sink a pump into them then, or you have an outlet and route it into a pump and that sort of thing? Or?
There are both styles of pump, and it all depends on your application, if the pump is well protected. If you've got it someplace where you can put a pump in a garden shed so it's not exposed to outdoor temperature, then an external pump is probably just as easy to use. But they also make internal pumps, so if you've got an area where you don't have any place protected to put it, you can put one that goes inside the tank. So, yeah, there's pumps for doing both, and I'll be quite honest, I don't have any preferences one way or another. Just basically whatever fits the application the best.
Right. Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. Right.
Very good. Okay. On to another caller here. This is Robinson. That's line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I've enjoyed your program for several years. It's a real service you provide.
Well, thank you for listening.
Okay. My question pertains to the roof on our house. It's about 10 years old, and it was a 40-year roof, and it's showing black streaks, and there's moss growing on the bottom edges of some of the shingles. I'm at the point where we had a hailstorm, and I may be putting a new roof on. And are there any brands of shingles now that last longer than when I put that 40-year roof on? I thought I had it, you know, mm-hmm. pretty well set. But.
Well, the black streaks and stuff are usually some of the minerals that they use for the mineral granules. It's amazing how much of that you can eliminate with a product called Shingle Saver. Basically, it's a zinc strip that you put just underneath the cap shingles at the top of the roof, and we have just enough acidity in the rain around here that we can get the zinc to kind of wash down and become an algaecide going down the roof, and it will usually prevent that from happening, the moss, the mold, the mildew, the streaking, things like that. Not used on a regular basis, but it is a good product. It's amazing what a sheet of copper will do if you were to put a copper ridge cap on it or something like that. Matter of fact, there's some houses here in Champaign-Urbana with an old cement asbestos roof that have some copper trim, and where all the dormers have the copper, the shingles look brand new, but every place else they're turning black and growing moss. So it's actually quite a vivid picture of what can actually happen by putting something like that up there. So I would say for your case, if the shingles are not heavily damaged from the hail, the addition of one of these Shingle Saver strips across the top would probably help reduce getting more moss or reduce or eliminate the black streaks. The black streaks are not detrimental. It's just a byproduct of some of the minerals that they put on the shingles.
It's just a metal strip that you would nail on there? Or
yeah, exactly. It's usually about an inch and a half or 2 inches wide. You can tuck it up underneath the cap shingle and put a couple of nails in it. And like I say, as the rain runs down, it just washes just enough of the zinc down there to keep anything from growing on the shingles.
Okay, appreciate the information.
All right, very good. And we have about 5-6 minutes left here on the program. In this hour, we're taking questions on home maintenance with Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. We do it every month, always on a Monday, and your questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Go over to Indiana, Pine Village, Indiana. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, for Scott, even though I'm calling from Pine Village, I live in West Lafayette and have city water, and I have a water question in that after our kitchen sink faucet has been off for a while, say overnight or during the day while we're away, and we come back and we turn it on, the water appears to have, just initially for a second or so, some carbonation. It fuzzes up and fizzes, and this is above and beyond any normal aeration, or so it appears, and when we collect it, we see some little bubbles in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it only happens apparently on this one sink. And it does take a certain amount of time, but it does seem like there's some gas that has been saturated into the water. We remodeled our house a couple years ago and haven't seen this until just, maybe the last 6 weeks to 2 months, and rather puzzled by what this is.
Well, I'm going to say that we are getting some type of gas in there, and it's usually, you say you're on city water, so it's something that I would bring attention to the city and say, hey, what's going on? I will also have to say it's slightly out of my area of expertise, which is one of those terms I don't like to use because I like to think I know a little bit about everything. I've seen this type of thing happen. I've seen the cloudy water. I've seen it actually, you pour a glass and it looks like a glass of 7-Up. It sits there and pops some bubbles on you. Mm-hmm. Since it's usually well water, I would probably try and contact some of the either the softener companies or some of the well companies and see if they would have some a little bit better information for you. But I would definitely let the city know that you're having this issue because it is something that has to be getting into the water at their end. It's not something that would be caused by your piping or any system that you've got in the house.
Okay, well, that's what I was wondering, if there was some kind of a latent chemical reaction that was generating this.
None that I am aware of. Like I say, I'm pretty sure that it's getting in on their side of the system, and likely what it is you've got that faucet is either first in line or in a place where most of the gas or the contaminants are rising to that area. And just the way the house is plumbed is why it's noticeable at that faucet, not the other
ones. I wondered if that was indeed the case.
That would be my guess, yes.
Well, the water people haven't been that excited about it, but I haven't worked that hard. I thought, well, perhaps I should do a little homework first, and I have called our water conditioning people, and I believe they'll be able to look at it next week. But they did tell me that, yes, they've run into methane and other kinds of gas in rural water systems and private water systems, but not in anything that was fed by a water utility.
Yeah, so, usually the city water that has that taken care of. That's why I was a little surprised when you said it was on a city water. So I would definitely let the city know about it. But, yeah, I would say your water softener company probably knows about as much about that stuff as I do or more.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you. We have maybe about 5 minutes. Somebody wants to call real quick. We can get him in, I'm sure. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Also, you can send an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I was just thinking, because we did have way back near the beginning of the program, we had a call from somebody who was saying that they were going to side a garage.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like they had already made the decision, or maybe you were expecting they had made the decision that was going to be vinyl. And so I'm just thinking about, well,
good,
you know,
point. Good point.
It's, and that's, there are other things that you can use for siding, and of course different materials have different advantages, although it seems to me like pretty much most of the siding now must be vinyl.
Well, the vinyl siding is less expensive to install, less expensive to purchase, and has a pretty long life, a good track record. So, yeah, just about everybody can install vinyl siding, not necessarily right, but at least can install vinyl siding because it's pretty quick and easy to put up there. Mm-hmm. Most of the vinyl siding nowadays looks pretty good. It is definitely pretty weatherproof, and we don't have to worry about painting it, so maintenance is down to nothing. So, yeah, usually when I see people doing siding, most of the time it's going to be vinyl. There are some very, very good concrete products out there coming back. Back in the 20s, we had cement asbestos. Well, now, of course, we don't want the asbestos, but there are some concrete boards coming back as siding, and that is, you know, good 80, 90, 100-year-old or 100-year life siding. It's a little bit more expensive. It's a little harder to install. It takes a little bit more time, but it's really good. A hardy board is one, a couple different types of systems. So, yes, there are several different ones, but I did make the assumption. Now, you got to give me credit. I made the assumption that it was a wood-sided garage with peeling paint. I made the assumption that it was detached.
You got it all the way. I mean, no, I'm not criticizing. I'm not necessarily criticizing. You seem to hit every one of those. So this new kind of concrete siding, is this something that comes with color in it, and you have to decide what color you want it to be, and that's what it's going to be? Or is it? Can you paint it?
No, you can paint it. It is a paintable material. It's basically, instead of the asbestos, they're putting in a fiberglass. They've done a lot more work with the chemical makeup of the concrete to make it a little bit more durable. It can be painted. It's a really good siding, unless, of course, you live right next to a golf course, because golf balls do tend to wreak havoc on cement siding.
So it'll break if you hit it hard enough.
Yeah. Well, yes, it will.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I guess vinyl siding will crack if you hit it hard enough, too.
I will have to admit, I had one of my more humorous inspections was I found a house that was apparently near the tee for one of the golf courses down in Tuscola, where it had a bunch of star cracks in the vinyl siding, and I just was puzzled by how these star cracks, I mean, 5-point, 6-point cracks in the vinyl siding, until I stuck my finger through there, and sure enough, there was a golf ball embedded in the foam sheathing underneath the vinyl siding. So it had been getting hit hard enough, it actually was going through the vinyl into the foam.
So if you think it'd be great to live by a golf course, you might want to size up where the location of the house is and make your decision there accordingly. So this concrete siding, so what does the surface texture look like? I mean, does it look like stucco, or do they...
They can actually texture it to where it has almost a wood grain finish to it. They have a little bit of... It's not a rough texture like a stucco. It does have a little bit of a graining to it, mm-hmm. so that it looks a little more traditional. But you can also get it in a smooth siding.
And the advantage is that it just has a very long life.
It's a very durable material. You know, aluminum will dent. This stuff can break if you hit it hard enough, but it would take more than it would take to dent aluminum. Steel makes for a great siding, except that steel rusts. So if you have a hole put in it someplace from a screw to hang something, you can get some rust on it. There is some very good vinyl-coated steel siding out there available right now that is very durable, again. The vinyl is just cost effective.
Yeah, okay. Any last thing you'd like to leave with folks this time around?
Well, I understand that you're going to be leaving us within a month.
That's what they tell me.
Yeah. So I'm kind of hoping that the show can continue on. And I really don't know if it'll do as well without you. But, hey, you've been a big part of it.
Well, as long as you're here, that's the important part. And we will do it one more time.
Okay.
Next month. All right. Thanks very much. Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. Once a month here on the program, always on a Monday, he's here. We talk about home maintenance.